In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Today we celebrate the Feast of All Saints of Russia, and one of the great, more modern saints of the Russian Church is St. Nicholas of Japan. He's, of course, called St. Nicholas of Japan because he was the missionary that established the Japanese Orthodox Church. He's also called the Enlightener of Japan. He was born in 1836, and his name at birth was Ivan Dmitrievich Kazatkin, and he was born in Smolensk. And he went to seminary in Smolensk and then went to the St. Petersburg Theological Academy in 1856 and was recognized as being a very brilliant student and was encouraged by his professors to pursue that track, become a professor. But as he was nearing graduation, he saw an announcement that was inviting anyone who was interested to apply to be the priest at the Russian embassy in Japan. And so he volunteered and was accepted, and he was tonsured as a monk, took the name Nicholas, and then he was made a deacon one day, and he was made a priest the next day, and then he was sent off to Japan. Not too long after that, I'm sure they gave him the 40 days so he could learn how to surf properly. But he had a 6,000-mile journey, and this is before they had a rail line that went from St. Petersburg across Asia. So he went by carriage most of the way. And he had to stop at Nikolaevsk for the winter of 1860 to 61 because it wasn't possible to continue to travel during the wintertime at that point. And as it happened, he providentially was able to spend that winter with St. Innocent of Alaska, who instructed him on the kinds of things that he would need to do if he was going to be successful as a missionary, because he had done it. He was old enough to be St. Nicholas's father, and he very much became a spiritual father. And the conversations that St. Nicholas had with St. Innocent were things that stuck with him for the rest of his life. But he told him, you need to learn the language, you need to learn the ways of the people, and he warned him to guard against despair, because being a missionary, being isolated, surrounded by people who are not the people that you've grown up with all your life, it would be easy to fall into despair. And he also made a point of getting him a new cassock and gave him a cross, because he said, you can't just wear an ordinary cassock if you're going to be representing the Russian Church in Japan. You need to look very nice. So he made sure he had a nice cassock. At that time, Japan was still under feudal lords, a shogunate, and it was illegal for Christianity to be taught. And their capital at that time was on the Isle of Hokkaido. And he spent quite a bit of time trying to learn the Japanese language, and he found it very difficult. This was at a time when there was no textbook, how to learn Japanese and, 100 easy lessons or anything like that. He had to do this the hard way. And he began at a certain point to give up, and he sort of withdrew to his academic interests. But providentially, St. Innocent of Alaska happened to be traveling, and his ship had to stop in Hokkaido and made a call on his young protege and saw what had happened and asked him why he wasn't being more diligent, told him to set aside those academic books and get about learning Japanese. And so he was given a renewal of his zeal that he had came to Japan with and put his mind to that task. It took him 7 years to learn Japanese well enough to preach it. And I've studied Japanese myself, and Japanese is one of the most complicated languages that there is. There are more complicated languages, but it's probably Korean that would beat Japanese. But it has conjugations and declensions and all that kind of stuff, and they use Chinese characters, and also they have, I think, two alphabets that they use to fill in the sounds that don't exist in the Chinese characters that they use. So it's a very complicated language to learn. There was one, I think, Jesuit missionary to Japan that said that it was a language invented by the devil to prevent the spread of the gospel. So that was his opinion on the matter. But he put his mind to it, and eventually he began to understand it. And he would also do things like go and listen to Buddhist and Shintoist priests preach, because he wanted to hear the language that they used to talk about spiritual things. And he would also listen to storytellers, because in those days, without TV, it was very common for people to sit around in a village and listen to some storyteller recount, you know, the heroes of old or something like that. And so he listened to these people. And eventually, his proficiency in Japanese reached a level where he was able to begin to translate text into Japanese. And he translated the entire New Testament and several books of the Old Testament into Japanese, and also the services. And these translations are still used by the church in Japan to this day. In 1869, he had his first converts, one of whom was a samurai who was the son of a Shinto priest. And he would come to the embassy because there was a Russian officer that was wanting his son to learn Japanese swordsmanship. And so this samurai would come there regularly to teach this Russian officer's son how to use a samurai sword. But whenever he would see St. Nicholas, he would glare at him because he knew that he was there trying to spread a foreign religion. And one day he came in, and there are different accounts of this story, but basically he had the intention to kill St. Nicholas. Came in there, hand on his sword, ready to take him out, saw him as a foreign devil sent here to corrupt Japanese culture. And St. Nicholas said, "Well, as a samurai, you're a man of honor, aren't you?" And of course, "Yes, I am." And he says, is it honorable to kill a man for what he believes when you don't know what he believes?" And he started to think, "Well, I guess no." So they began to have spiritual conversations. He began to explain to him what it was that he believed, and eventually he converted to the Orthodox faith and became the first native Japanese priest to be ordained. And he was baptized with two other converts in 1869. He established a system for training Japanese catechists. They would train people who had converted, teach them the faith, teach them thoroughly enough to where they could go out and they could spread the faith. Because St. Nicholas was only one man, he actually appealed to the Church of Russia to send him more priests because he needed help. There was no way that he could do a whole lot of work as a single individual. But the Church of Russia only, I think, sent him one other additional priest. And so he began to use the local people. And I studied missiology as a Protestant, and his approach to missions are the kinds of things that now people who study this professionally would say, "Well, that's the way you do it." You know, this. But back in those days, Protestant missionaries would go to a foreign country, and their approach was to teach people English and then teach them the faith in English. The idea of learning the culture and trying to make it relevant inside that culture, as opposed to just making them into Americans, was something that was not done in those days by most missionaries, but he did it. And this was at a time when being a Christian was still illegal, and in 1871 there was a persecution of the church, and many were arrested, including the samurai priest. And none of these people wavered in the faith. They all confessed their faith perfectly. And I didn't see in the life that any of these people were killed, but they certainly were arrested. But in 1873, the emperor of Japan, and at this time the shogunate had been overthrown, and the emperor had been restored to having actual authority rather than just authority in name only. And the capital was moved to Tokyo, but he allowed for religious toleration. So then St. Nicholas could really do what he wanted to do in terms of reaching out. And the Japanese government began to take note of St. Nicholas because he not only could speak Japanese and Russian, but he could speak several other European languages. And so they began to use him on some occasions as a translator. There was one instance I believe it was in 1891, where Tsar Nicholas II, who at that time was just the crown prince, the Tsarevich, came to Japan, and there was a Japanese policeman that tried to assassinate him, and he actually gave him a gash on the forehead that was about 9 centimeters. This is metric in the life, so I don't know exactly how that converts to inches, but 9 centimeters. And it was only one of his relatives that parried the second blow that saved him from being killed. And at this time, the Japanese military was no match for the Russian military, and so they were very concerned that this would be a pretext for Russia to go to war with Japan. But St. Nicholas used his diplomatic skills to help both sides smooth this over, and so nothing bad came of this. By 1878, he had already converted about 4,100 people. In 1880, he became a bishop. He had appealed to the Church of Russia to send a bishop, and their response was, okay, well, we'll make you a bishop. So he went back to Russia, they consecrated him, and then they sent him back to Japan. In 1891, he built the cathedral in Tokyo. He had moved his center of operations to Tokyo when the capital moved to Tokyo, and he bought the highest hill in Tokyo and decided that that would be the best place to build this cathedral. And it's a beautiful cathedral, and it's a landmark that everybody in Tokyo knows, and they call it Nikoraido, which means basically the House of Nicholas. And even though it's the Church of the Resurrection is the proper name of the church, but if you are ever in Tokyo and you want to see it, if you tell the taxi cab driver Nikoraido, he'll take you there. And it survived World War II, amazingly, because we firebombed Tokyo and destroyed quite a bit of it, but it was not damaged. In 1904, there was a crisis that could have destroyed everything that he had done up to this point. Russia and Japan finally did get into a war, and many people told him, well, you need to leave the country. And it would have been very easy, if he had not handled this properly, for the Japanese Orthodox Church to be seen as enemies of the people and being destroyed by the Japanese. But he refused to leave. But what he did was he told his priest, you pray for your people, and in your services, you pray for the victory of your country, and I'll withdraw myself from the services, and I'll pray for my people and for the victory of my country. And he told them, be loyal citizens, defend your country. And of course, the war didn't go well for Russia. They had a fleet that they had to sail all the way around the world from the Baltic Sea around the Horn of Africa, and by the time it finally got there, the Japanese, who had built up their navy by that time, were able to wipe that fleet mostly out. And so there were many Russian prisoners that were taken captive, and St. Nicholas and the Christians that he had converted ministered to these Russian people. And actually, he found that most of these Russian soldiers that were captured were ignorant and they were unable to read. So he had people teaching them how to read and teaching them the faith. So Japanese Christians teaching them the faith. And when the war was over, he came out of it with great respect from the Japanese government. They saw this was really a wise man. This was someone who handled this well. And the Russian church recognized the wisdom of it as well, and they made him the Archbishop of Japan in 1907. By the end of his life, he had established 266 communities, either churches or mission stations. There were 33,000 people in the Japanese Orthodox Church. And he was the archbishop. He had an assistant bishop. He had 35 priests, 6 deacons, 14 teachers of singing, and then 16 catechists. What can we learn from a man like this? One thing that we can learn is the importance of instructing our people in the faith. We could do a lot more as a community in terms of reaching out to people if we had more people in the parish that really put their nose to the grindstone and tried to learn the faith. You could become a catechist. It would be nice to have people who are going around town and doing things like Bible studies or catechetical classes at different places in the city, because we all live over the city and during the week it's hard to get together here. But if we had people who are willing to do it, that would be wonderful. And you know how you can do it? The pastoral school our diocese runs has a catechetical program, so you can become a certified catechist. So being a catechist is a real thing, and there's no reason, if you've got the mind to do it and the will to do it that you couldn't become one. But that zeal for reaching out to people who are around you is something that we all need to have. That we have a world of people who are lost, we have a world of people who are hurting, people who are miserable, people who are suffering from the sins that beset them, and we have a treasure. And it's a sin for us not to share that treasure. I preached a couple years ago a story from the Old Testament where the city of Samaria had been besieged, and people in the city were starving to death, and God, by a miracle, had destroyed the army of the Syrians that had besieged the city. And these four lepers wandered out one day because they figured, hey, if the Syrians kill us, we die, but if we stay in the city, we're dead anyway, so maybe they'll feed us. So they go into this camp, and they find all this food and this treasure and this loot, and they're sitting around, and they're eating, and then at one point, one of them says, you know, we better go back into the city and tell people about this, or we're going to be punished. And the spiritual lesson of that is we're like those lepers that have hit the jackpot. We found all this food, and we've got a whole town full of people who are starving to death because they don't have the food that we found, and we need to tell them or we will be punished. That's the important lesson that we need to learn. We have an obligation to try to share our faith. And that doesn't mean that we need to necessarily go door to door like the Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that, but we should be trying to find ways to share our faith with people. And it can be in small ways, making friends with people, joining, you know, some club or something like that that is a forum where you're going to meet people who are not Orthodox, and then befriending people. Because if you build those kinds of relationships, you can share your faith with those people. St. Nicholas reposed on February the 3rd, Old Style, 1912, and towards the end of his life, he had been asked to go back to Russia. Why don't you go back to Russia and retire? And he said, you know, unless a missionary is totally incapacitated, it's improper for him to leave the field of his work. And he stayed there till the day of his death, and his relics remain there in Japan. And the Church of Japan remains a strong church. And his legacy is very much evident. There was a man that I knew who was in the Marine Corps. He was stationed on Iwo Jima. But he traveled to Tokyo because his wife had given birth to a baby. And so his baby was baptized in the cathedral in Tokyo. But one funny story he told me was is they still used a pair of wooden scissors that St. Nicholas had made for them. And those wooden scissors worked very well on very thick-headed Japanese babies. But when you had a peach fuzz Caucasian baby, they were just trying to scrape that head with those wooden scissors, and they weren't getting very much. But his memory is still alive today, and they're still using the wooden scissors that he made for them in the cathedral. What a wonderful legacy. We all have opportunities in our life to establish a legacy, maybe not on the same scale, but we can bring people into the faith, and they'll thank us eternally, and we will be rewarded eternally if we do so. Amen.